Everybody, is that better? Okay, perfect. Sorry about that. So what I'd like to talk to you about today is a pediatric brain tumor with which I'm intimately acquainted clinically and scientifically. And I want to use this study of this tumor as an illustration of how information from many different fields in science have coalesced to lead us to some important potential therapeutic implications for the tumor. And what I'll do is I'll review findings from these various different fields and try to pull them together to try to show you how a developmental biology approach to studying this brain tumor is incredibly helpful, especially since this tumor does occur in young children. And I'll finish off by showing you a little bit of the story that we're contributing as well. So this is a clinical problem, and this is a very abnormal mass that's arising in this 5-year-old boy who came to our emergency room with a 2-week history of vomiting and problems walking. And he's got this very large mass that's arising from the vermis of the cerebellum. So you can see here that it's large. This is a sagittal cut of an MRI scan, and this is a large and heterogeneous tumor. It's pressing on his brainstem. It's obstructing his CSF pathways, causing the fluid spaces in his brain to blow up, and this is making him very sick. So he immediately goes to the operating room, and we find the tumor, and in lucky cases where it's nice and discreet, we can remove it clearly. And the diagnosis here is medulloblastoma. This is the most common malignant brain tumor in children. It's a primitive neuroectodermal tumor, and for almost a century now, people have thought that it arises from an abnormal primitive cell that arises from the vermis of the cerebellum. And basically, this tumor does have a rate of metastases that can drop from the tumor down the spinal axis and feed the cerebrospinal fluid, and we know that clinically this is a predictor of very poor prognosis. Basically, right now, when we stratify these children to undergo further treatments after surgery, like chemotherapy and radiation, we're stratifying them based on mostly clinical and pathological risk factors. And so we look at these children and we estimate how much of the tumor the surgeons have left behind. We look at whether they're feeding their spinal axis, and we look at their age. And we put these factors together and we then stratify the patients into average risk or high risk patients, who then merit different doses and regimens of chemotherapy and radiation to further treat their tumors. And what we know is that the poor risk subgroup of children had only a 30% 5-year survival, whereas the other subgroup of children have an almost now 90% survival rate with the same treatment modalities. And so the question, clinical question that's posed here is, why do the children with the poor clinical pathological risk factors do so poorly? And how can we further stratify that group and understand it on a molecular basis? So I think our understanding of medulloblastoma first came from two areas that I'll discuss briefly, which is one thing is familial cancer syndromes, and the second thing we'll move into is normal development of the cerebellum. This is really a tumor where so much of what we understand about the cancer biology comes from our understanding of the normal anatomy and development of the cerebellum. So a lot of our understanding of medulloblastoma came from the study of patients with Gorlin syndrome. And this is an autosomal dominant cancer syndrome in which patients tend to develop multiple neoplasms, mostly basal cell carcinomas and as well as medulloblastoma. And these patients are also, interestingly, in terms of the other talks today, exquisitely sensitive to ionizing radiation. So about 25% of patients with medulloblastoma carry mutations in genes in the hedgehog pathway, and what we've learned is that Gorlin syndrome has a germline mutation in the patch gene, which is the cognate receptor of the soluble ligand sonic hedgehog. So a lot of our understanding of the signaling pathway and how it's dysfunctional in cancer has actually arose from this syndrome. So mouse models were further developed to mimic this, to explore the relationship between the hedgehog pathway and medulloblastoma, and a mouse breed was generated, a patched one heterozygote mice. These mice carry a deletion of one copy of the patch gene, and they all have features of Gorlin syndrome. So 14% of these mice go on to develop medulloblastomas, and what's interesting about that is that not all the mice get medulloblastomas, so obviously there's cooperative mutations or events that must happen. But similarly, other genetic syndromes have mutations in another developmentally important signaling pathway, the Wnt pathway. These patients have a mutation in the APC gene in the Wnt pathway, and they develop colon cancer and medulloblastoma. So we learned a lot about the signaling pathways that are disrupted in cancer from these familial cancer syndromes. And then on to what I mentioned about normal anatomy. We have also learned a lot about medulloblastoma from normal cerebellar development, which is one of the areas of the brain that we know the most about, because it's the only part of the brain that actually continues to develop postnatally. And in fact, the cerebellum is still continuing to develop and grow in children up to 2 years of age. So it provides some unique opportunities to model and to study this region of the brain. And as a result, we actually have a lot of spatial, temporal, and topographical information about exactly how the cerebellum develops and how the cells actually speak to each other. So another topic that came up, I think, in a lot of the running theme of today is microenvironment. And I'm going to talk a little bit about cell-cell interactions here in terms of microenvironment. So it's quite fitting that tumors that arise in early childhood may actually occur from dysregulation of normal developmental signaling pathways. And so the study of medulloblastoma development actually finds its template in the study of the cerebellum. So the cerebellum arises from stem cells that occur within the rhombic lip of the developing embryonic cerebellum. And what happens is that you have primitive neuroepithelial cells that arise in the roof of the fourth ventricle. You remember in the original MRI, that fluid space that was squeezed shut by the tumor. We have our primitive stem cells in the roof of the fourth ventricle, and they migrate over the cerebellar surface to become external granule layer precursor cells. They then migrate inwards to form another internal granule layer. They become postmitotic there, and they differentiate terminally. And this process is not complete until, as I mentioned, 12 to 24 months of age. But what's very interesting is how some of these cells in the cerebellum actually communicate with each other. So in terms of the hedgehog pathway, when we studied hedgehog in the developing cerebellum, we find that these outer external granule cell layers, which are proliferating, this proliferation is actually regulated by the secretion of hedgehog. And the interesting thing is that there is a very important cell-cell interaction in that these cells, this cell layer called the Purkinje cell layer, actually secretes the hedgehog. But the hedgehog then travels and binds to patched receptors on the external granule cell layer precursors. So you have a very important microenvironmental interaction that regulates the ongoing development. And again, with anything where you see something is regulated closely in a temporal and spatial fashion, you wonder what happens when it gets dysregulated for any given reason. So what happened is that what we know is that the mitogenic effect of hedgehog is very important for granule cell precursor proliferation. And what happens when you actually develop hyperactive hedgehog signaling? So evidence suggests that medulloblastoma originates from dysregulated signaling in certain developmental pathways such as hedgehog. And we know that you can get hyperactive hedgehog signaling either by having too much hedgehog or by having an abnormal patched receptor as well. And so basically, this led to this hypothesis that something goes wrong during granule cell development in terms of hedgehog to generate an abnormal tumor. And again, just a similar sort of concept that hyperactive hedgehog signaling can lead to medulloblastoma formation. So then from this observation that a very important developmental signaling pathway can lead to the genesis of a tumor, we began to look at other developmental biology models within medulloblastoma to show that this actual dysregulation of cells on a spatial and a temporal basis within normal anatomical development actually correlates to the dysregulation of specific signaling pathways that are active at that stage in development and actually gives rise to tumors of different phenotypes. And in this very important paper by Richard Gilbertson's group, what they discovered is that they decided to study Wnt signaling in particular because it's dysregulated in Tourette syndrome, and they developed a conditional beta-catenin P53 mutant mouse model, and beta-catenin being a very important activator in Wnt signaling. And basically these mice develop medulloblastomas that arise from the dorsal brainstem, whereas the medulloblastomas that arise from the sonic hedgehog generated tumors tend to arise in the vermis of the cerebellum. And so what you notice is that they actually went back and using a cross-species genomics model between human and mice, they went back to human patients and correlated that they found that the tumors that arose from these specific locations correlated with the signaling pathway. So this is the first concept of taking all of our spatial topographical knowledge from development and correlating it to cancer and actually pinpointing certain signaling pathways that were disrupted. And furthermore, Then a lot of elegant experiments arose from other developmental biology approaches where we can drive expression of certain oncogenes using lineage-specific promoters. And this developmental neurobiology approach has really lent a great deal of information to find out what the cell of origin is, in particular in medulloblastoma. And so what you see here is that a series of papers were published and this is just one of them, from Robert Wexler Reyes' group, to show that basically you can delete patched using lineage-specific promoters in all of the different cellular compartments that make up the brain. So depending on what promoter you use, you can conditionally delete in astrocytes, which are mature, fully developed cells, or neural progenitors, such as the external granule cell layer precursors, which specifically express MAS1, a protein called MAS1, or in neural stem cells, which may express CD133 or Nestin. And so by using this lineage-specific approach, what they find is that you can actually get medulloblastoma arising from either a progenitor compartment or a stem cell compartment if you delete patched. So it's providing some information now in terms of how the tumors may be hierarchically organized and which cellular compartment may be the most permissive to transformation events. And again, some very elegant models on the Creelox recombinase system to find the cell of origin of medulloblastoma to conditionally delete patched one in the different cellular compartments. So these are very elegant model systems that have an additive sort of compound, add an additional layer of knowledge to our study of medulloblastoma. So in 2005, there was an important paper in Nature Neuroscience on normal cerebellar development, where, again, Robert Wexler Reyes showed that the postnatal mouse cerebellum has multipotent neurostem cells that are CD133 positive, and they arise in the roof of the fourth ventricle in that area of the rhombic lift that I showed you before, where the original patient's tumor was on the first MRI. So, and Marina and colleagues further showed that CD133 positive, MAS1 GFP positive, negative cerebellar stem cells, when you put in FLOX mutations or alleles for certain very transformative oncogenes, P53 and retinoblastoma, they would generate medulloblastomas when injected into mouse brains. And the tumors seem to originate from cells that express stem cell markers, SOX2, SOX9, and other stem cell markers. So, and furthermore, when they went back and looked at these stem cell markers in human medulloblastomas, they found they identified a subset of human medulloblastomas with a very poor clinical outcome. So again, this was a sort of one of the first hints that medulloblastoma signaling pathways that are disrupted in medulloblastomas, identified pathways that are active in normal stem cells. And again, furthermore, you can see the big decrease in survival in the human patients that actually express the stem cell markers. So this kind of also, this whole concept of medulloblastoma arising from a stem cell gained some further traction from this paper from McBadia's group, where he actually had a very interesting model where he could take normal human embryonic stem cells and drive them to become neurogenic precursors, and that when they were subjected to conditions that he used to transform them, that they would give rise to tumors that looked very much like medulloblastomas. And the interesting thing is that depending on where you transplanted these tumors, they could give rise to different germ layers. So if you put these tumors, for example, under the skin, they actually formed tumors that had other germ cell lineages in them. But put them into the brain, and they only develop into medulloblastoma. So again, a hint that microenvironment is important, and the fact that even an even more primitive stem cell could give rise to a brain tumor under certain conditions. So this is a very interesting paper that came from Sally Temple's group, where basically what she's trying to say here is I found it extremely eloquent, actually, that she would use some literary analogies. It's always nice when scientists can use literary analogies. So she basically was writing this paper to show that tumor-initiating cell models have contributed to our understanding of medulloblastoma. And this question arose when she was reviewing Robert Wexler Reyes' paper on CD15 positive neural stem cells. So what she's saying here is, where do medulloblastomas come from? Do they come from stem cells? Do they come from progenitors? And do these tumor-initiating cells come from normal cerebellar stem cells that have somehow made a deal with the devil to never grow old like Dorian Gray, or from later progenitors that grow young like Benjamin Button and they reacquire their stem cell properties? So again, the cellular populations identified through all of the studies I've shown you are the CD133 positive stem cells arising from the roof of the fourth ventricle, the CD15 positive progenitor cells arising from the external granule cell layer, and this whole concept of that perhaps they both give rise to medulloblastoma, and it's simply different subtypes with different outcomes. So again, all of the knowledge that we've gained about signaling pathways and medulloblastoma can actually help us stratify the patients into different clinical outcome groups that may actually help us much more than the clinical pathological factors that we currently rely on. And then furthermore, looking at then carrying this into the sort of human realm as well, medulloblastoma stem cells, do the concept of these stem cells actually predict prognosis or therapeutic response? There's a lot of papers that then take these markers, like CD133, which identifies that ventricular zone stem cell, and they found that when you look at that in human patients, it actually predicts a very poor prognosis in medulloblastoma. And furthermore, many other different stem cell genes and developmental signaling pathways that are active in tumors also predict a poor outcome. So now the final sort of layer of things in terms of looking at all of the information we've used to study medulloblastoma is genomics. And basically, the aberrant expression of key developmental and signaling pathway components in medulloblastoma was fully characterized in the recent decade using multiple integrated genomic platforms. And so this resulted in a new molecular classification system of medulloblastoma consisting of four subtypes that are distinct in terms of patient outcome. So we've discussed two of them based on all of the knowledge that I've shown you to date. The first subtype, which is known as the A or the Wnt subgroup, actually has tumors that seem to arise in the Richard Gilbertson model from the dorsal brain stem. They have they represent a minority of the overall tumors. They have an excellent clinical outcome, which is very unusual in terms of cancer. We usually think of Wnt activation associated with a poor outcome, and in medulloblastoma, it's associated with a good outcome. The hedgehog pathway is the second subgroup. And then we have another two subgroups, which are currently known as groups 3 or 4, or C and D, and 3 or C has recently been characterized by the expression of the MYC oncogene. So again, you can see that in this summary, this is from a recent meta-analysis consensus paper of all of those other genomics papers I showed you. You can see that people have been able to speculate using all of those elegant developmental neurobiology approaches on the cell of origin, which is also playing into the prognosis of these patients' tumors. So the groups that we're most interested in are these last two, because as you can see from this chart, these kids are the ones that have the worst prognosis. And they are the ones that still remain relatively uncharacterized. You'll notice that other than the recent discovery about MYC, we really don't have a lot of information about what signaling pathways are disrupted in these subtypes. And so what we found is that a couple of recent papers published in Cancer Cell show that no matter whether you're looking at cerebellar stem cells, the CD133 positive ones, or the external granule cell layer progenitors, the MAF1 positive, CD15 positive ones, what you find is if you infect either of them with MYC, you do get medulloblastomas. And so again, that consolidated the findings about the subtype C. So this is Michael Taylor here in Toronto. His recent Nature paper has again combined all of the approaches that I've shown you, which I'm sort of hinting at in this talk, that I really think the best way of getting at this problem is to combine all of the different scientific approaches and information we have already. So this is exactly what he did. And what he did is he took all of the genomics platforms that he had access to and that he helped to develop, and found that within all of the particular subtypes of tumors, he was most interested in studying the ones that metastasize. And what he found is that in those in the metastatic compartment of medulloblastoma, there is a clone or a certain select number of cells that actually seem to be completely distinct from the primary tumor, but very much alike to all of the other metastatic clones. And this sort of brings into play, again, the concept of the cancer stem cell, which is escaping the current therapy, running down to seed the spinal axis, and generating the metastatic tumor, which unfortunately leads to the poor outcome in children. And what's very interesting is that that he found that MYC was actually one of the only genes that was commonly expressed between the original primary tumor clone and the metastasis. So maybe that's one of the links or one of the key links in terms of poor outcome. So in my lab program, what we're really trying to get down to is we're understanding that perhaps some of the signaling pathways that are active in those poor subtype aggressive medulloblastomas, the children who currently have the poor prognosis, may actually be stem cell driven pathways. And so what we're looking at is, with our model system of the brain tumor initiating cells, we're using our model system to study medulloblastoma in order to find out what the key genes are that drive self-renewal of brain tumor initiating cells, and to find out whether a subgroup of those genes will actually be the genes mechanistically implicated in the currently unclassified type C and D tumors. So it seems like we all like to put up these complex signaling pathways, but really all I'm trying to show here is that if we call these three signaling pathways the usual suspects, we've got Wnt and Hedgehog and Notch, and these pathways are of course the ones that are active in key developmental processes and also in many cancers. What we notice is that it's not easy to oversimplify and say, well, when Wnt is involved, then you have this type of tumor, and when Hedgehog is involved, you have this type of tumor, because the problem is that in terms of cell signaling, all of these pathways converge on each other. There are common hubs, like GSK3, that actually all three pathways converge on, and of course, everything is much more complicated than we think. So I guess what I'll show you now to sort of finish off is that we're trying to contribute to the understanding of how these developmental signaling pathways are dysregulated in medulloblastoma, specifically in medulloblastoma stem cells, because it seems that some of the pathways on which these pathways converge, some of the mechanisms on which these pathways converge, involve key stem cell self-renewal genes. So very briefly, I'll touch on four little stories here. One is how the sonic hedgehog pathway actually feeds onto a key stem cell self-renewal gene, BMI1, and how further, it's sad that actually Antonio Fasano isn't here today, the study of normal neural stem cells and FOXG1 actually led us to look at the interplay between BMI1 and FOXG1 in medulloblastoma, where we found an interaction. A very small story that I'll just gloss over on an HDAC inhibitor that may be important in medulloblastoma, and finally, some exciting findings about the Wnt signaling pathway. So, very briefly, I'll just show you the work that started this for us. So, this is some of the work that we've recently looked at, where we've basically realized that our BTICs are a good model system because there's expression of Hedgehog, Notch, and Wnt. All of these signaling pathways are active in our stem cell model. So the BTICs provide an excellent tool for examination of developmental signaling pathways, preferentially active in stem cell populations. So we wanted to investigate the link between Hedgehog signaling and BMI1 expression in medulloblastoma. And basically what this slide shows you overall is that there is a potential feedback interaction between Hedgehog and BMI1 that regulates the invasiveness of medulloblastoma in an in vivo model, as well as the size of the tumors and the propensity for metastasis. And the very interesting thing is, going back to the whole Purkinje cell, external granule cell, cell-cell interaction and how they speak to each other using the Hedgehog pathway in normal development, we found that a similar interaction exists within medulloblastoma. And what we found is that the CD133 positive cell, we have realized that they express all of the pathway components of the Hedgehog receptor system. So they express patch, smoothened, and all of the downstream proteins as well as BMI1, whereas the CD133 negative cell seems to be secreting Hedgehog, so that these cells are actually within the tumor microenvironment potentially regulating each other. And this illustrates very much the concept that you may be able to isolate a bunch of cancer stem cells, but actually the other cells may be equally critical in terms of regulating the crosstalk and the microenvironment. So we were interested to look at BMI1 because within this paper we found that BMI1 expression increased in a linear fashion as the prognosis of the patients worsened. So here's the A subtype, the best outcome group, which is Wnt signaling regulated, the B subtype, Hedgehog, C and D. We found that BMI1 was most highly expressed in those tumors that have the worst outcome. And so that led us to look at another subset of stem cell genes, which within medulloblastoma, we went back to all of those genomics databases that I had described to you earlier, and we specifically looked at a subset of stem cell self-renewal genes to find out if they were in any way predictive in terms of looking at them as combined gene signatures. And what we found that was very interesting is that BMI-1 and FOXG1, when we looked at them across the board, they're all preferentially expressed in the C and D subtypes, the aggressive and poor outcome subtypes. And again, going back to Dr. Fasano's work, in normal neural stem cell populations, Sally Temple and Antonio Fasano showed that BMI-1 actually cooperates with FOXG1 to maintain normal neural stem cell self-renewal. And so similar to what we've learned about normal neurobiology in the cerebellum and how that relates to medulloblastoma, we wondered if these findings in normal neural stem cells had anything to do with brain tumor initiating cell populations and in the dysregulation, and perhaps they're dysregulated in medulloblastoma. So what we did find is, and this is just recent new data that we've just come across, is that in fact BMI-1 and FOXG1 do regulate each other, even on potentially an epigenetic level, where we are showing that there's actually promoter occupancy of the gene, each gene at each other, and they seem to cross-regulate. So we're exploring this further right now. And just to show you a little bit more in terms of looking at these BMI-1 gene-driven gene signatures, we actually found an 11-gene signature downstream of BMI-1 that seems to identify, again, the poor outcome subtypes. The signature is intimately associated with patients who have metastases. And so we went on to look at these genes in more detail and found that one of them is CULLIN3. And just to sort of touch on how all of these approaches are leading us down sort of new paths to discover new things about medulloblastoma, when we looked at CULLIN3, we actually found that there's been some excellent publications by the group of Alberto Golino already showing about how CULLIN3 is part of this ubiquitin ligase complex, and that in fact it regulates hedgehog signaling through gliacetylation. And so there's a very interesting interplay of when the downstream targets of the hedgehog signaling, the glies, are hyperacetylated, they're not able to get into the nucleus and regulate downstream transcription. And so what we found is that we think that CULLIN3 is involved almost as a tumor suppressor gene within BTIC populations, and that perhaps that if there's a mutation in CULLIN3 and you get less deacetylation of the glies, then they're not able to activate and to form tumors in mice. So that's another sort of vein that we're exploring right now that arose from the data on the stem cell self-renewal genes. And there's that story right here. So I'll finish very quickly just to show you the last little story, which is, again, something not empirical or not that you wouldn't necessarily think from looking at cancer stories in general, why should this occur in medulloblastoma? But again, the stem cell data led us to this. So Wnt signaling in general is thought to be associated with more aggressive cancers, activation of the Wnt pathway, in almost every cancer subtype except for melanoma, where Randy Moon's group has recently shown that Wnt activation within the setting of melanoma actually controls the disease and results in control of metastatic spread in a melanoma mouse model. So what we did is we actually went to look, and this leads directly to the concept that the Wnt-activated tumors, the first subtype of tumors, the A subgroup, actually have excellent prognoses. And so we wanted to explore whether that excellent prognosis arose from direct Wnt activation activation of the Wnt signaling pathway in medulloblastoma stem cells. And so what we find is that when you activate canonical Wnt signaling, it actually reduces the self-renewal capacity of medulloblastoma stem cells. And so this is something we're following up on right now very avidly with some in vivo work and with a new drug that we found that Randy Moon actually used to study in ALS, but it's a Wnt activator, and so we're currently looking at that in an in vivo model to see how it actually mitigates tumor formation. So I'm just going to finish on that note to show you the people who did the work, my lab, members in my team who have learned along with me as we've walked through the path of all the discoveries made in medulloblastoma. We've tried to integrate all of these things using our BTIC model system in order to sort of contribute to the story that is currently developing very well in medulloblastoma. And I find the developments of the past decade so promising simply because it's moving away from the clinical pathological stratification more towards a molecular specific, a patient specific, and a more sort of individualized type of therapy. And I think we're getting closer with this tumor, perhaps more so than any other brain tumor. So very exciting new discoveries, I'm sure, to emerge in the next years. Thank you, Fiz.